And lastly, bring your mind around to the western direction. And again, establish very carefully, very gently, the perception of all the magic in this world, all the amazing people, all the amazing potential that is out there. What a wonderful and remarkable place this is. And all these beings out there, all wanting and deserving happiness. May every one of you, may you be happy. May you be well. And towards the very end, just imagine the whole planet Earth in your mind's eye, and see the whole planet Earth bathed in a beautiful, golden, kind and compassionate light. It's that light that emanates from all the Ariels, all the noble beings, when they have kindness towards all beings. So we also join in. May all the beings on this planet, everyone down there, everyone in this world, thank you for being part of this planet. May you be well, may you be happy. And just allow your mind just to come back to being the passive observer and just enjoying the silence for a few moments.
Okay. Okay, so here we go. First question for tonight. How does seeing non-self prevent craving from even arising, since craving is something naturally selected from evolution and hardwired? Okay. Perhaps it is, perhaps it isn't. I'm not so sure. It's hard to know sometimes where the lines are drawn between natural selection and other phenomena. It is not always so clear. And from a Buddhist point of view, a lot of the mental faculties that we carry with us in this life are not necessarily from evolution, but the mind is often a separate entity in Buddhism. It is the physical body that is a construct or a consequence of evolution, but the mind is often the consequence of karma from the past, what we did in the past, right? So craving is a slightly, it's hard sometimes to draw a precise line where the mental development comes from somewhere else, and the physical components is a matter of evolution. There isn't any hard and fast rules about that. But there was an interesting article I saw recently. He was an evolutionary psychologist, this person, and this is precisely what we're talking about here. And he was saying that by doing meditation and practicing the Buddhist path, you're going against the stream or the evolutionary psychological ideas. You go against that because you're practicing a path which goes in opposite direction. So whereby, according to evolution, we are kind of evolved to crave, as you're saying here. That was his argument. I'm not sure if it's true, but let's assume it is. In meditation, you are actually going against that. So you're kind of deconditioning that genetic evolution that has happened over a long period of time. And so that is the case, even if there is such a thing as evolutionary psychology. But if maybe from Buddhist point of view, maybe that is not really a theory. I know it's still a very new phenomenon in research, evolutionary psychology, and I'm not sure how far these things should be taken. So yes, so it is possible to go against these things, even if we don't see non-self, but much more so if you see non-self, because non-self is the idea that there's nobody in charge, right? How can you crave? How can you pursue things if there's nobody really in charge to do these things? Anyway, I'll just leave it at that, I think, for now. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have been following and studying the Buddhist path for about a year now, and out of both good logic, reason, and meditation experience, I've come to have great faith and confidence in the Four Noble Truths, impermanence, non-self, and karma in relation to this life. However, as I was somewhat of an evangelical atheist priorly, I naturally have some skepticism about rebirth. Do you feel accepting rebirth is fundamental to the Dhamma or necessary for deep states of samadhi? If so, what could you recommend to prove such a phenomena to myself, or at least inspire some more confidence in the possibility? What was it that convinced you, with much metta? Okay. It's not necessary to accept rebirth as such. You don't have to say, you know, go around declaring that you kind of believe in rebirth. It's not really required. I have a lot of sympathy for people who are atheists. I lean a little bit in that direction myself. If I wasn't a Buddhist, I wouldn't be Christian or anything like that. I'd probably be an atheist myself, or at least an agnostic, perhaps. So I can sort of sympathize with that. So it's not really so much a matter of accepting it. It's more a matter of being open-minded about these things, right? And not kind of close off the idea. Very often you hear, the problem with science these days is that there is, remember that science also has a lot of assumptions in it. And the kind of modern materialistic outlook of science is lot of that is assumptions about the mind, assumptions about the human being works, and also assumptions are built up to give a worldview which would tend to reject things like rebirth. But actually, the evidence in these areas are very, very slim, and there's very little. As we all know, the knowledge of the mind from a scientific point of view is very thin and very very uncertain at the present moment. Even though people reject it, the actual evidence isn't very strong. And for that reason, I think that you can take into account other things when you decide about things like rebirth. You can take into account anecdotal evidence. Anecdotal evidence becomes very powerful when there isn't any kind of final scientific solution to these things. So what is this anecdotal evidence? And one of the most powerful anecdotal evidence is just the fact that the Buddha said this, right? The Buddha is clearly a historical figure. He's someone who must have been astonishingly impressive in this heyday to be able to start a thing like Buddhism. He said some extraordinarily wise things in the suttas. And if this person said that there is rebirth, it is for me at least very hard to reject it out of hand and say it's just nonsense or rubbish or whatever. I feel that if the Buddha said this, well, then at the very least, I owe it to the Buddha to take it seriously at the very least and to consider it very carefully, even though accepting it fully is a different matter. So that is the first thing that the Buddha said so on. The other thing is that you find people in this day and age who will tell you to your face that there is rebirth, in the sense that I have seen it, I know that there is such a thing here. And again, it's like when someone you know and someone you kind of trust says this thing to you face to face, it's very hard to reject it if you know that this is a person of integrity. And not only integrity, but a person of, who has a mindset which doesn't tend to take things on board just on faith, but tends to investigate things. That's the second thing. And the third thing is that there is actually a fair amount of fairly good evidence out there of this phenomenon called rebirth. Of course, it is, if you go on the internet, you will find a lot of people who try to debunk these ideas. But regardless, I think, of how many people are trying to debunk it, the evidence is actually still quite strong. And this is things such as, children remembering past lives, for example. Some of the evidence there is actually quite phenomenal. There is a research group at the University of Virginia in the US that has something like 3,000 cases on file of children remembering past lives. Some of them very, very, very powerful cases. And it's like there was a philosopher at the University of Georgia who said, after reading this book by this researcher called Ian Stevens, he was a philosopher, right? He said, after he read this book, he thought, well, you have to consider the possibility of rebirth after reading this book, simply because the evidence is so powerful in there. The most natural explanation is that there is rebirth. Other explanation might be possible, but that is the most natural one. So that is another type of evidence, right? And there's lots of things, little things like that, but added up, to me, makes it seem certainly the idea of rebirth is not as impossible as some people would have it in our present world. So sometimes you have to kind of go against the mainstream. We all know that the mainstream can often get it wrong. We often know that it takes time before these kind of paradigms, the scientific paradigm of the present moment, there's a certain view. But suddenly there's a shift, right? And suddenly the paradigm shifts and the whole world starts to look upon certain phenomena in a new way. There's a famous book called, which you may have heard of, called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And that book shows you how science goes through paradigm shifts and suddenly everything changes and everybody looks at the world in a new way. So these things happen. Anyway, that's some of the things that I would do. But just keep on practicing it, and just see what happens, and just keep an open mind, and think about these things. Be independent in the way you think. Don't be too trapped one way or the other, and then see how you go from there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, we are ever grateful for this education. It is an excellent. May you attain nirvana. Okay, that is very kind of you to say that. So may you attain nirvana too. May we all attain nirvana. May we all move in that direction, right? That is the way. Good. Okay. One last request. If anyone wishes to donate your body after death, please call. Okay. There's a phone number here, University of WA for medical research. Okay. 64883288 apparently is the phone number you have to call if you wish to donate your body after death. I have to warn you, I think sometimes they have quite strict criteria for what kind of bodies they accept. If you're too old or too kind of whatever, then sometimes they don't take your body. So there's a... It's terrible, isn't it? They don't want your body if you... So anyway, that's a nice idea. It's all these things we can do, right? We can kind of extend our generosity even into the... after we're dead in many cases, which is quite nice. Anyway, I'll put that to one side if anybody wants to find out about that phone number. Dear Ajahn, when a person meditates, can he stay in the present moment without focusing his mind on the breath and the body, etc.? Thank you. Yes, you can do that. And this is the thing, you can just be aware, right? This is what the kind of idea of present moment awareness is. You can just be here and now, and just be aware in the present moment. And this is what mindfulness is all about. It's just the ability to be aware. And you will see that this happens sometimes. You walk through the forest, right? And you just have this awareness of the forest around you. You're not focusing anything when you're walking through. You're just experiencing. I just did that this afternoon. It's a beautiful, so beautiful around here, especially at sunset time. And you look at the large trees, right? And just feel the forest. And there's a certain awareness there, just a presence of mind there. So yes, it is possible. You can just sit here and feel the peace. If you just experience the peace of sitting here, and you're just aware of the peace, that is also mindfulness without being focused on anything here. So this is it's good to develop that. It's not going to be perfect. There's always going to be, or not very likely, there's going to be a few stray thoughts going through your mind, you know. And then it becomes peaceful again. There's a few more stray thoughts. So it's not a perfect peace all the time. It comes and goes a little bit. But you will see that as you sit down, the mind tends to become more and more peaceful as you relax. And the less you do, the more you just sit back and enjoy whatever is there, the more peaceful the mind becomes, right? You just wait and wait. You're just very, very extremely patient and just wait. You don't do anything. And that the very fact that you don't do anything means you're not feeding the thinking mind. And by not feeding it, things tend to become peaceful. So yes, it can be done. The problem is that if you go to the breath too quickly, it's impossible to stay with the breath because you haven't got enough peace yet. And because it's impossible to stay with the breath, it means that you grasp the breath, you hold on to it. And because you hold on to it like that, after a while it becomes unpleasant. It becomes as if the mind becomes a little bit stressed, it doesn't really relax properly. And this is the grasping, and then after a while you get tired and you get restless. And this can take a while, but you will see that the mind doesn't really settle down properly. So it's good to learn this basic idea of just being able to be passive, just being in the present moment, just being aware. It's a very useful thing. And it comes, the more you integrate the whole Eightfold Path, all the virtue, all the ideas of focusing in the right way on the world, all of that, when it gets integrated together, then mindfulness is the result of that. Mindfulness comes out of that. That's actually what happens. So it's a gradual thing, and every year you come on a retreat, you find that your mindfulness is more powerful, right? This is the idea. Every time you come back here, you think, wow, this year is better than last year. That's what's happening, then you're on the right track. If that's not happening, you have to ask yourself if you can improve something in your practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can one be agnostic and Buddhist at the same time? Okay, so the other day it was about atheist and Buddhist, now today is agnostic and Buddhist. I think agnostic is thinking that there may be a God, but we can't prove that there is a God. This is a result of being brought up as a Christian. Can we be agnostic and Buddhist at the same time? I guess there may be a God, but you can't prove that there is a God. I would say, yes, you can be agnostic, but it's more like maybe there is a God, maybe there is not a God, right? That is the kind of agnosticism we probably should have. Don't have a real opinion about it. It is obviously the case that the Buddha makes it very clear that there is no sense of self, right? There is no, actually there is nothing that corresponds to the sense of self that we have. So there is no permanent entity inside. And that idea of no self corresponds with the universal idea of there not being a God. God is like a big self, right? A permanent creator God. It's like a big self, the Maha, the Brahma of the universe, whatever you call it. And the soul, what we call the soul in a human being, that is just like a small version of the same thing. And the Buddhist idea undermines both at the same time. They're both either accepted or both rejected usually. They go together. They're the same kind of idea about the world. There is some kind of permanent thing there. So please be, it's okay to be agnostic. If you feel it is difficult to give up the idea of a God entirely, but try if you can to have this openness of mind that perhaps there is no God, because otherwise this idea of a God can eventually become a hindrance on the path. So perhaps there isn't any God. What's wrong with that? Isn't it okay if the universe has no God? Do we really need this? Do we need a God in this universe, or can we just live completely without that? And I think it is perfectly okay to live without that idea. In a sense, I think it is, can be liberating, even depending on your psychology and who you are. It can be liberating not to have a God in there. You take full responsibility for your life, and that's actually a good thing. So I hope that helps. I'm not sure if it is exactly what you were after, but anyway, that's it for. Okay. Please raise three sadhus for the services of Bianca, Dania, and Burr. Okay, so three sadhus, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah. Well done. Yeah, it's wonderful that we have people who are so dedicated to looking after the retreat center and coming to every retreat and sorting everything out. So Bianca, Dania, and Burr are the three people who are basically in charge and run this retreat center on a daily basis and take all the bookings and do all the retreats and everything. And it's wonderful that we have so many people in the Buddha society who do so much service to everybody else. That's indeed a very, we should all be very grateful for that. Okay. How does seeing non-self prevent any rebirth producing craving to come about? Please explain the cause and effect of the mechanism. Thank you. What is rebirth producing craving? Please give an example. Surely they will crave food. Okay, so the craving, in a sense, there's three types of craving that the Buddha talks about, which are like rebirth producing. There's a craving for sensual pleasures, a craving for existence, and then there's a craving for even for non-existence. And all of these three cravings, it's like you are looking into the future, right? You are craving for existence, about what you want to be, how you want to exist. Craving for sense pleasures, about how you're going to get these things. And craving for non-existence also is the same thing. You don't want to exist in the future somewhere. So your mind is always kind of projecting something into the future, always looking to the future. And the sense of self wants to kind of continue in the future to exist in a certain way and to experience pleasure. And as long as that craving is there, it's that craving which actually drives the whole mechanism of rebirth. And I think sometimes to actually be able to really grasp what is going on, how that works, you actually have to see it. And this is one of the problems with Buddhism sometimes. Sometimes you need a bit of confidence to start out. And some of these things, it's almost like you have to take them on confidence, because it is hard to really fully grasp how that mechanism works. But essentially you are building up this kind of self that you're projecting into the future. And as a consequence, that's actually what happens. You keep on existing because of that. So the rebirth producing cravings are the craving of sense pleasure, of craving to exist, right? You want to exist, you don't want to give up. And also the craving for non-existence, if you had enough of existence. And sometimes people do that Surely they will crave food. Yes, they will crave food. They will still have desire for food. That's why an arahant will still eat. But they won't have that craving for the sense pleasures that involves food. It's a very different thing. It's a very different category of craving and desire. One is like this hunger, this thirst for something. This kind of, I have to have this. That's why it's called tanha. The Pali word tanha literally means thirst. Whereas the craving for food is just the, okay, I've got to keep the body going, so you eat, and that's really all there's to it. If the craving for the sixth sense pleasure is a craving to be, it depends what how you define craving, because the thing about desires come in many different categories, right? There is very coarse desires, the kind of desires you have for sensuality are often quite coarse and very strong and very, that's why they call thirst, right? Tanha is a thirst. You have thirst, you have to have these kind of sense pleasures. Whereas the cravings that come, for meditation and for the sixth sense pleasure, is a craving of a very different type. It's a very much more subtle thing. So I don't know if craving is the right answer, the right word for that. It's more like, yes, there is a certain desire there for that stillness and peace of samadhi. But craving is not necessarily the right word. Craving for existence is more about, you want to exist, basically. In whatever way you want to exist, craving existence is part of that. Yeah. It is okay, but that's who is going to hinder your meditation practice to some extent, right? If you have a lot of desire for meditation, if you sit down and you have all these desires, it's going to stop you. If you're always waiting for the bliss, oh, may the bliss come. It's not going to be very helpful. So you have to, even there you have to be careful. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on to this one. It's probably better if we can avoid the questions. If you want to have a question, maybe better to write it down and I can have a look at it. There's still one more night tomorrow. Okay, dear Ajahn, can one still be a lay person living in the lay world and still be enlightened and be an arahant and go to Nibbana? Because Ajahn, I have it all figured out. Okay, that's why there's a long essay coming next year, so this is the essay. Yeah. Okay, so I'll answer the question after I have read read what you have to say here. I can still live by myself in my own house where I don't have to ordain with Ajahn Brahm and live with everyone out in the sticks. The sticks is great. It's the best place. What's wrong with living in the sticks? It's not. It is wonderful. I recommend living in the sticks. If you don't, anyway, I can change my career and go back to study a master or PhD and get a very high-paying job, save up millions of dollars in the next 10 to 20 years. Unless you die in the meantime, of course. But anyway, buy a house, invest my money, live off the interest, and I don't have to work anymore. Also, I don't need contact with people. Buy my food online from Coles and get it delivered. And I don't have to drive. And if I need to go anywhere, I can catch a taxi or be driven. I don't have to handle touch money because it's all online via credit cards. And I'm keeping all my precepts. I don't have to mow the lawn or cut the trees, and I won't be harming or killing anything. I will hire a lawnmower man and a gardener. I can do everything and live like a monk or nun in my own home, keeping all my precepts. Ajahn, I've got it all figured out. Can we still be a lay person to get enlightened, become an arahant, and go to Nirvana? Is it possible? Okay, this is like a dream, right? Remember the other day we were talking about this fantasy of the world. We fantasize in our heads, we have these dreams, and then one day you wake up and you realize it was just a dream. This is like that. This is like this dream you have. right? And these kind of dreams are—they don't usually work out quite the way you want them to. If you really enjoy the solitude, if you really enjoy to be by yourself, if you enjoy the peace, the best thing you can do is to come out and live in the sticks, right? For goodness sake, is it the best thing? You go into a kuti, it's beautiful, it's peaceful, you're in nature. There's nothing is better than that. Aren't you enjoying your time here at Jhana Grove? You're in the sticks now compared to living in the city, right? So this is basically, I think the more you understand about the peace of the mind and the peace of what these things are about, the more inclined you are to live in the forest. You don't want to be in the city anymore. You'd actually like to get away from all that. So why on earth would you want to live in a house or an apartment or what it is when you can have a kuti in the forest? So basically, I think it just this is just kind of a big fantasy, right? And yes, often we fantasize like this. But usually the reason why the Buddha laid down the idea of going forth, the idea he did that, is because that's what he did. And that's what brought the best results, right? In the practice, that you go forth, you become a monastic, and you kind of withdraw a little bit from that world. That is what gives the best kind of results. And because of that, this is a very powerful thing to do. So can you be enlightened and be an arahant? You can, in theory, you can do a lot, right? There's a lot of things that you can be done in theory. But remember that a lot of these questions are theoretical. If I say yes, well, according to Buddhism, yes, it is possible to go a long way on the path. Maybe not be an arahant, but go a long, long way. Far enough, so it doesn't really matter if you're an arahant or not. But in practice, is it really possible? How possible is it? Have you got enough support in lay life? Have you got enough Kalyana Mittas? Have you got enough reading of the suttas? Have you got enough in-depth explanation of what is going on? Have you got enough peace, withdrawal into the forest? All of the factors that are so supportive for achieving these things are not going to be there. And if all the factors that are so supportive for achieving things are not going to be there, then it is not the ideal situation. Can be done for very special people. Are you that special? How special are you? If you can sit down here and you can just close your eyes and you can go into this very profound samadhi, which is pure bliss, and sit there for hour upon hour, then maybe there is a chance, possibility. But it is very rare to find people who can do this kind of things. And anyway, those people who can do those kind of things, they incline to living in the forest, living far away. This is what you will find in your usually in your life. So it's good that you have figured it out, but think about it. This now time to come. If this is really what you want to do, then do it. But that's fine. But just keep reflecting. Maybe this is not the final solution, the best way of going about things. Anyway, okay. So I hope that helps a little bit. Okay, dear Ajahn, I was hoping for some historical insight into the bowing before statues and monks and nuns. I don't wish to disrespect the Sangha or lay people, but I calculated if I bow to you and a statue every day, this equates to minimum 100 bows and a maximum of 260 bows in 9 days. This seems unnecessary. I am fearful of rites and rituals as they only ever increase. And yes, I'm aware that my mind should not become a ritual of aversion on this. Can you help me to be respectful yet pragmatic on this subject and add some historical facts with metta? Okay, well, basically it's voluntary. You come in here, you can bow exactly as much as you like. I don't mind if people don't bow at all. Personally, it's perfectly okay. So that's really up to you. Just do what feels relatively natural and relatively easy for you. Don't do things if you find it hard or it doesn't kind of work out. Then it can become like an obstacle sometimes in your practice if it's too difficult. So do what feels natural. But the idea behind this, as I was saying the other day, is just that what you are really respecting is the qualities of Buddhism, right? The qualities that are there, the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities that we are developing on this path. That is really what one is respecting. And there's something very nice about bowing sometimes. When you bow down, there's a sense of humility there, a sense of kind of softening up of various things. You feel a bit softer afterwards sometimes, not always. Sometimes it becomes a pure ritual, as you say, but sometimes it softens you up a little bit. And you feel a bit more humble in front of the kind of the awe of some of these qualities and states that we are trying to develop. And when you have a bit of humility and a bit of awe, it kind of opens up your mind a little bit, and you have kind of less sense of self and perhaps a little bit less conceit, right? Conceit is always a problem, right? And then you there's more chance of actually gaining these kind of states that we're trying to get to. But historically, these things come from the time of the Buddha. This is they did something roughly similar at the time of the Buddha. They would bow down and pay their respects, and this was part of the cultural phenomenon in India in those days. That's just the way people did things, whether it was towards the Buddha or it was towards other people, other spiritual leaders or whatever. And in this present day, you will find that in some Buddhist countries, you find that people bow not just to monks or nuns or Buddha statues, but you will, for example, you bow to your teachers, right? You bow to a teacher, or you bow to your parents. You know, you wake up in the morning, you see your parents, and you bow down to your parents before you go off to school, right? And it's quite nice, isn't it? It's quite a nice thing to do. Why shouldn't we do that? So it's just from a Western point of view, it is a bit difficult because you have to get used to it. But once you get used to it, it's actually a beautiful little ritual to do, at least every now and again. But again, do it if you feel at ease with it. Do it occasionally. Do it maybe once a day if that's all if that's enough. Or don't do it at all if you find it goes too much against the grain. But try it out, because if you try it out, you may be able to find something beautiful in this idea of bowing. Yeah. And it's good exercise, right? 216 bows in 9 days. Yeah, it's really... Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Okay, Dear Venerable Ajahn, as I understand, consciousness arises through six institutions, the Salayatana, the six senses, through contact. It is also my understanding that some of these consciousnesses may cease while some others would continue to exist. My question is whether all consciousness created by the six Salayatana get bundled into one single consciousness at death and travel as a stream of consciousness to the next life. Thank you, with metta. Thank you again for the great explanations. Okay. Good. So what is going on here is that you're quite right. There are six consciousnesses, each one to do with each one of the senses, right? Sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. So these are the five, and then you have the mind as a sixth consciousness. And when you meditate, you can start to feel how the consciousnesses start to turn off, right? When you become very peaceful, basically you don't have much sense of, certainly the taste and the smell disappear very quickly. You don't see very much, you have your eyes closed, sometimes that sense of sight gets turned off. And after a while, your body starts to disappear, right? You don't really feel your body very much at all. The deeper you go, the less of the body there is. And eventually, even the hearing kind of cuts out completely eventually as well. So you actually, this is a process of meditation, a process of becoming peaceful and calm. It's a process of the senses, the five sense consciousnesses, of the five senses gradually disappearing. That is what is happening there. And you are all experiencing that to some extent in your meditation right here. This is what's already happening. And when you dream at night, right, basically you only have the mind consciousness. And the mind consciousness has all these kind of fantasies and all these things going on. And this is the thing about the mind consciousness. The mind consciousness is such that it can take the content of the other consciousnesses. So that's why you can dream at night. That's why you can fantasize about things, right? It is the mind consciousness which takes on board the other consciousnesses. So that's what happens when you die. When you die, it is the mind that continues. But the mind has some remarkable capabilities. It's actually interesting. The mind seems to have the ability, when you die, you have an out-of-body experience. at that stage, according to kind of the Buddhist idea, that you have an out-of-body experience, you die, and you can still experience the world around you. You can still see, but you see without the physical eye, right? You can still hear, but without the physical ear. So actually, I think it's fair to say that even the six consciousnesses are still present, or at least some of them are present, even after you die. So it's not just the mind consciousness, it seems like there's a bundle of many consciousnesses kind of moving on, and that is the mind moving on into the future life. So you can still see, right, just with the mind, somehow, I'm not sure how that works, but that seems to be the case, at least from the Buddhist point of view in these things. So the stream of consciousness is then just this bundle of different consciousnesses going together, moving off into the future. Okay. Dear Arjan, can a woman be enlightened, become an arahant and go to Nibbana? Or do we have to be virtuous this lifetime and come back next lifetime as a man, so we can become arahant, enlightened and go to Nibbana? Thank you. Yes, women can become enlightened just as men can. There is no difference. In fact, this is, I think this is directly said in the Pali Canon, that women can become just as enlightened as men, and there's no difference there. Remember that what matters here is your conduct, is your ability to be virtuous, your ability to have a pure mind, your ability to, and this will then give rise to insight. And if you have a mind, then you can do it. So, there's no difference as far as these things go. In fact, it can be said that when your meditation becomes very profound and very deep, the gender difference disappears, and you are just a being. So how can you talk about the difference between a woman and a man anymore? There is no difference. Once you get into very deep meditation, that difference is completely gone, and you're just a being, without genderless being. So because of that, you can see that gender actually is quite irrelevant, because you go beyond that at a certain stage on the path anyway. There's no more gender there. It's gone away. But regardless, the Buddha made it very clear that there's no distinction in that area. It's just as possible for women as it is for men. So there's no excuse. Don't say, I want to become back as a man first. That is the wrong way of thinking. Just get on with it now. You have every chance, just like everyone else. Isn't that good? So you have every... it's all there. Okay. Dear Arjan, why the Buddha and some arahants, Ajahn Chah, before passing away, have to suffer illness, sickness? But why my friend's grandfather, the only feel unwell a few weeks and getting well? One day he woke up in the morning, he took a shower, had his breakfast and lay down on his bed and passed away with peace. So why is this? The Buddha didn't have very much suffering before he passed away. It was fairly easy, but he had, of course, some suffering. Everybody has a little bit of suffering, but remember here, that is the most important thing, is that the suffering in the mind is no longer there. So yes, some of these arahants, some of these Buddhas may have some physical suffering in the body. Ajahn Chah obviously had a very bad case of illness before he passed away. But very often their mind is still bright and they're still able to kind of detach from a lot of that physical suffering. Yes, it is a problem, it is still not nice, but it's not a major issue. The vast majority of the suffering we have is due to the reaction, the mental reaction to the physical suffering. That is the main problem, right? We react to the mental suffering in the wrong way. And because of that, that is why we suffer so much. The Buddha talks about the two darts. The two darts is the physical suffering and the mental suffering. And once you pull out the dart or the mental suffering, there's only the physical suffering left. And that is a very tiny dart compared to the mental one. What is the reason? Well, it's just the nature of the body, right? Sometimes the body goes wrong. And you can't really say that it is due to karma or not karma. It's just the nature of the physical body. You never know what's going to happen with the physical body. It is so uncertain and so unsure. So because of that, and this is one of the things which is a little bit kind of worrying about samsara, right? Going around. We never know what's going to happen to us. We may make lots of good karma, but still, at least in this life, we are still subject to the deterioration and suffering of this particular physical body here. You just don't know what's going to happen to you here. So there is uncertainty. It could also be that some of these arahants and Ajahn Shah, perhaps there was some karma that was left over from the past, perhaps. It's very difficult to know. So that they were bound to suffer in this life. That is another possibility here. So, we have to be careful not to explain too much in terms of karma. Karma is mostly to do with how we move from one life into the next one. You do good karma in this lifetime, you get a good rebirth in the future. But we have to remember that once you are reborn as a human, then all of these human things tend to happen. You get sick, the body falls apart, you lose your job, your relationships break up. All of these things are just aspects of being a human being. We can't blame that on karma. We can only blame it on the fact that we are human beings. So we shouldn't be surprised when these things happen. One of the interesting things is, for example, when you had that tsunami, you know, that big tsunami about 10 years ago, whatever, and there was 100,000, 150,000 people who died, and whole villages and towns were wiped out in certain places, like the north of Sumatra was probably the area that was most devastated. And a large community, how can you explain that everyone in a certain area was wiped out? Did everyone in that town have exactly the same bad karma? Doesn't make much sense, right? That's not how the world works. Everybody with bad karma accumulates in one place and then they're just waiting for this wave to wash them away. It doesn't make any sense to me. I think what is the obvious explanation there is that some of those people may have had bad karma, but the vast majority were just ordinary people in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's the problem with life. Life is uncertain, and these things can happen to us sometimes even if we haven't got bad karma. If you have bad karma, it will happen for sure. If you haven't got bad karma, it might still happen. If you have really good karma, you might be somehow saved from these things happening, right? That is usually how it works. There's no absolute guarantee. Life is just so uncertain. Once you have been reborn as a human being, you already have potential problems in your life. So that was the mistake you made, was getting reborn as a human. So that was the problem. Actually, it's pretty good to be reborn as a human. You get to practice the Dhamma, you get all these wonderful teachings. So it's not a bad thing at all. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, if suitability is an aspect of clear comprehension, how could it not be part of Satipatthana? While doing Satipatthana practice, it may be better to walk than to sit. Due to sleepiness, knowing what is suitable to the practice would be needed during Satipatthana. Yes, sure, that is correct. But remember that when you practice the path, is that you take the earlier steps, you take them with you into the later steps, right? So even though suitability comes before Satipatthana, you bring that suitability with you into Satipatthana. Even though virtue comes before Satipatthana, before the jhanas, you bring the virtue into the meditation practice. So the previous steps are the foundation stones that you bring with you into the subsequent steps. You don't kind of abandon the previous steps and then move on into the future. So yes, my point is just that this is not something that is just Satipatthana. I say it actually happens before that. And that is what I understand to be clear comprehension, Sampajanya. Okay? Okay. Last question for today. Dear Ajahn, could you please expand on the two types of stream entry? Specifically, you said something about returning and non-returning. Also, you mentioned a three-month stay at the monastery. I would like more information on this. Okay? Three-month stay at the monastery. This is during the Rains Retreat. And the Rains Retreat is an annual retreat that we have at the monastery. It begins usually in July and ends in October. And it's quite hard to get a room at the monastery because it's very popular to stay there for the Rains Retreat. That's when we don't do any work and everything becomes very slow and easy at the monastery here. It is possible sometimes to stay here at Jhana Grove during the Rains for longer periods. But again, that you have to check with Ajahn Brahm directly, because he is the one who organizes that. So that is roughly what the 3 month stay at the monastery is. Certainly this year, I don't think there's any possibility, but maybe in future years there might be a chance to do this sort of thing here. Okay, so the two types of stream entry. So the thing here is that there is, according to Buddhism, there is four types of noble people, four types of Aryas, they call them Pali. And these are like the four stages of awakening. You go through stages. The first stage is when you kind of make the first breakthrough. And for the first time, you see what the Buddhist teaching is all about. And that kind of opens your eyes. And that is where you kind of undermine the defilement and the sense of self once and for all. And from there on, you're actually guaranteed to eventually reach full awakening. So that stream entry is the first one, right? You are banned and certain of the fetters, of the things that bind you to samsara, are abandoned at that particular point. And then as you go through the various stages, the next stage is called once returning. Once returning means that you can come back to the human existence or the sensual existence in the sensual realm one more time before you kind of make it out of samsara. Samsara is the round of birth and death, right? Going round and round and round before you make it out. And then you become a non-returner. A non-returner is when you destroy, or you not destroy is not a good word, when you make an end of all sensual desire and all ill will, right? No more sensual desire, no more ill will. And you're a non-returner, means you get reborn in a very, very high realm, a very pure realm, equivalent to the very deep states of meditation, the jhana realms, and the realms of the Brahma Viharas, the metta and compassion realms. You call a non-returner because you never come back again to the human realm or the sensual realm. You go there, and from there you make a final exit from samsara. And then there is the highest type of awakening. It's called the arahant. And the arahant, the fully awakened person, is the one who never gets reborn anywhere ever again. You are a human being, and when you die as a human being, that's it. You're finished. Make an end of everything. No more rebirth, no more running around and around in this samsara. Okay, so I hope that helps. So that is all the questions for tonight. So we are coming towards the end of the retreat, so please continue enjoying yourself. Have a good time. And just relax. Sometimes people think, oh, it's coming to the end, now I have to practice really hard. But if you have been taking it easy and relaxing, just continue taking it easy and relaxing. And then that is how you will be able to enjoy even the last part of this retreat to the maximum. Okay, so we'll see you again tomorrow morning.